Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, a former policeman from Palestine, Bill Smith. Also, Ed Lander is talking about IT security, and he's a real insider, a professional. And Jason Yannakopoulos is talking about Change 100. I asked him, what's it about? He said, wait, and I'll tell you. Dialect is produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733, or you'll find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. So we start this week with Bill Smith, a former policeman in Palestine, and much more besides Bill. Welcome to Dialect.
Welcome.
Bill, just to begin with, could you say, were you a volunteer? I mean, we were just talking about volunteering Bristol. You volunteered. When did you volunteer?
I volunteered when I was in the Merchant Navy. I decided the war was over and the Merchant Navy wasn't going to be my scene, so, and I saw the adverts.
So when were you first in the Navy then? When did you join it?
Beginning of 44.
Right, so you actually saw some wartime.
I had to go in at 15 and a half. I was a youngster, you see, so 15? My father had to put my age on to 16.
15 and a half. And what were you doing in the Merchant Navy? What kind of ship were you on, or ships?
Or tramps. Small tramp steamers.
So steamers, really?
Coalburners.
Where were you going then?
Oh, all over the place. America, Canada, South America.
So you're part of the Atlantic
convoys, yeah.
Oh, convoys, crikey. Well, tell us about some of those, because they're, you know, this was a very perilous time, wasn't it?
Not when I joined. Well,
no,
it was nearly all over. Say it was 44. We were still in convoys, but I never saw anybody ever attacked or anything like that.
So there was no action for you.
No, none.
Well, that's fantastic, isn't it? Because I mean, but certainly the beginning of the war, it was one of the grimmest areas to be. I mean, imagine that, 1,500 miles out in the middle of the Atlantic, and your boat suddenly gets sunk in the middle of the night. It must have been dreadful. But what sort of stuff were you bringing over?
Everything, food. We brought tanks over on one ship, locomotives on another, but mostly food.
And you're saying that in Palestine, you went there from the Merchant Navy. You decided that the Merchant Navy was kind of winding down.
It wasn't my thing anymore.
And so what made you decide to choose to do something like that?
Well, if I hadn't have joined it, I'd have to have been called up for the army, because the Merchant Navy service during the war didn't count towards conscription. So when you left the Merchant Navy, you were automatically conscripted into the army, and I didn't fancy being conscripted, being told to go anywhere. So I joined the police.
Okay, and what were your first impressions of Palestine? When did you get there?
Well, we went to Port Said originally, and then we went by train over the Sinai Desert to Gaza, where we got trucks from Gaza to a place called Jenin, where we did our training.
Now, we get used to thinking of that part of the world, what used to be, thousands of years ago, the Holy Land, but we get used to thinking of it as Israel now. Why? In what way was Palestine, what it was when you were there, different?
Oh, it was controlled, mandated to the British. It was a very nice place, except for the terrorism. It was a nice, the people were nice, the Arabs were, and a majority of the Jews were quite nice.
So you actually went there when you arrived, terrorism had already begun.
Yes.
And this is Zionist terrorism. Yes. Tell us a little bit about, you know, what the grievance was that the Jewish terrorists had at the time.
Well, it all started way back. It started when we were given the mandate in the big Paris Peace Conference, I think 26 or 28, I don't know.
Between the First and Second World Wars. Yeah.
That's right. Well, the Arabs originally thought it was going to be theirs, and the Jews thought they were going to have a homeland. Well, during the conference, Wiseman, which was the Zionist leader, he met King Faisal, which was the Arab leader, and they decided, well, Faisal didn't want Palestine. He only was interested in Damascus and Syria. That's all he was really interested in. But in the end, he signed a paper to say that the Jews, the Zionists, could go to Palestine. But then he wrote in his own hand a thing on there saying, if the Palestinian Arabs agree. So that left it wide open. We'd signed the Balfour Declaration saying the Jews could have it. And we'd also signed one with King Faisal saying the Arabs could have it. So it was a genuine mix-up. Well, they allowed certain Jews to go there between the wars and during the war and after the war. Of course, by then, there were so many American Jews that wanted to go to Israel and the pressure from America, they forced a bill through the United Nations to say that the British mandate would end.
Now, what about the European Jews, though? Because, I mean, this is one of the things that we certainly, the impression is that in the Hitler's reign in the 1930s, there were a lot of Jews in Germany that wanted to get away, and Israel would be the obvious place, as somewhere where there'd already been the Balfour Declaration, a homeland for the Jewish people.
Yes, but then we the British agreed that there would only be limited immigration into Palestine. And of course, the Arabs didn't like that, so in the 30s, they had the Arab Rebellion.
But, I mean, how did you start going about policing it then? Because you've got two completely conflicting communities, really, haven't you? You've got Arab people looking at one piece of paper that's been signed saying it's theirs, and you've got Jewish people looking at another piece of paper that's been signed to say it's theirs. How did you go about policing what was it? Get bound to be a conflict zone, really.
Well, we policed in the middle. We got chased by both sides. Not so much the Arabs, but a lot of the Jews did not like us at all. But a lot of the Palestinian Jews were quite pleasant. We got on quite well with them.
Now, hang on. What do you mean? What's the difference then between... was there a difference? It seems to be you're implying between the immigrant Jews and the Palestinian
yes,
Jews.
Yes, there
well,
was
what,
a difference.
Tell us, because, I mean, you know, nowadays, certainly, there doesn't seem to be any difference.
Well, in my time, that the trouble was mostly the Jews that come from were the Polish Jews. Begin, they were the mostly the troublemakers.
When you say that, you mean the terrorists?
Yes.
And there was quite a lot of terrorism going on, bombs going off. Did you find that when you very first arrived, or was it something that sort of petered out, or did it get more?
Oh, no, no, it was going on. Of course, when we were in our training, we were in a place camp called Jenin, which was virtually an Arab area. It was quite safe. But when we finished our training, I went straight to Haifa, where was a big Jewish colony in a place called Hadar HaCarmel. And that wasn't a very lovely place, but they didn't like us very much.
Well, so, I mean, okay, but were you saying both sides didn't like the British? Or was the, because it sounds to me like you're saying the terrorism was coming from the Jewish side.
It was. We never had, except for police business, you know, with same as you get in Bristol. That's all the trouble you ever got with the Arabs.
Okay. Okay, so you were in a police headquarters, weren't you, when actually it was attacked. Tell us about that.
Well, it happened one morning.
What year are we talking about, roughly?
47, I think that was.
Okay.
The place had been blown up before. So what they'd done, they'd put a wire fence down the middle of the main road, which was Kingsway. Down the middle of the road, this fence was about 12 feet high, all the way down the middle of the road. Well, one morning, a 1,500-weight truck come down, and it had a ramp on it. An angled ramp, where the bottom of the ramp just fitted over the wire. And on there was two 40-gallon petrol drums welded together, covered in tires and filled with explosive. And they just rolled it down the ramp. It bounced over the wire and up to the main doors of the police headquarters and went bang.
Crikey. Well, where were you when that was happening?
In bed. If they'd have waited another half hour to an hour, they'd have got nearly all of us in the mess hall having breakfast.
Crikey, so I bet you got up pretty quick. What did you see?
Oh, of course, they hit the main headquarter building, and I was in a side building that used to be a post office. So it didn't really affect, it just blew some windows out. But the headquarters building, it had gone virtually to the front door and straight up inside. And it killed, I can't remember, seven or eight, I can't remember how many it killed now, and injured an awful lot.
And was the place then completely out of operation for how long?
No, never went out of operation. No, it was still always, they never went out of operation ever. It was always in operation.
Now, during policing, did you have, liaison with the Jewish community and the Arab community?
And oh, yes.
Was there you know, any attempt to really try and reconcile the two? Because obviously, you know, a lot of the disputes are coming between the two communities. And were the police ever able, or you as police, ever able to actually bring the two to speak to each other?
No, they wouldn't. They were completely separate communities.
Well, that's very difficult. What were you doing day to day, though, you know, as an ordinary policeman?
I was in an operational unit. We had light armoured cars, and we used to patrol the streets. And then if we weren't on patrol in the streets, we were on escort duty, running all over Palestine. Whatever was going, we went to Jerusalem, Nazareth, you know, everywhere.
Armoured cars? It sounds more like the army build than the police.
Yeah, well, they were very light armoured cars. They were built in Canada. They were GMCs. They only had two Bren guns on them.
Okay. Also, you're, I suppose, what is looked on from other parts of the world. Were you aware that the world was watching what was going on there? Or did you think maybe, because we look now at this as really the seeds of a lot of today's problems in the Middle East. So were you aware that this, you know, was something that the world was watching and that may in the future become something as intractable as it has? Or has that been a surprise to you through the rest of your life?
No, it wasn't a surprise. We just didn't think of it. We were just doing the job we went out there to do. It wasn't until the end, when we knew we had a date we had to be gone by, that it all come about, that we all said it would be a mess. It couldn't be done. I heard that the Americans, in the end, asked Bevin, who was the foreign minister in those days, to ask them to stay a bit longer, because they knew they'd made a mess of it. But he wouldn't stay, and it was quite right. They made the mess, and it's been a mess, and it'll always be a mess, until, in my estimations, Palestine goes and Israel takes it over, which it will do.
You think so, yeah?
Oh, yes, because I don't give it 10, 15 years.
I mean, if you look at the amount of land that the Israelis now completely control, that is getting bigger and bigger, it seems, all the time. And,
yes.
There's not a lot of land which is old-fashioned Palestine left and controlled by Arabs.
No, the Israelis are very crafty. What they do, they move up to a village, one insignificant little village, and they just empty it, move the Arabs out, then destroy it. But nobody will take any notice because it's one insignificant little village. And they just move in, slowly.
What you seem to be saying is that terrorism pays.
Well, if you've got the back of a major country like America, yes, of course it does.
Now, did the Americans get involved, do you think, you know, quite early on? Was it was controlled by the British? Was it simply the fact that the Americans came and sort of helped take over? Or was it just a completely independent state as Israel? Were the Americans involved in all that?
Well, they started the State of Israel. It was the American money, American equipment that started it. Without America, well, even today, I don't think Israel would exist today without America.
Amazing. Well, I mean, this isn't really, I mean, it's not so well known that America was there right at the very start.
They weren't there on the ground. There was no people there, but it was their influence behind it.
Okay, so it was kind of given a financial backing from the US. Now, it seems a bit naughty, doesn't it? I mean, did you wonder at the time, why are the US backing these terrorists? Because they were at the time Jewish terrorists, weren't they?
Well, yeah, because there was there were so many Jews in America. That is as much as it is.
So it was a Jewish lobby back home in America that was doing a lot of this. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, Weizmann, the instigator of it all originally back in the 20s, he was an American.
So there was of course, in Britain and America together, I suppose, were at maybe even during the war, were thinking, well, this is a place going to be a Jewish homeland after the war, and hadn't necessarily told the Arabs about it.
That's quite right.
Okay. What about other incidents? Because I know you were involved in a search for two sergeants that went missing.
Yeah.
Were they colleagues of yours?
No, they were army sergeants. They got picked up by the Irgun's Vailumi, which was a terrorist organisation. And because we were going to hang, or we had hung, some terrorists that had been caught. And they said if they do that, they'd hang. And they did. They hung a pair of them. And they booby-trapped their feet, and some young army officer got there too close and to cut them down, and they went off, and he got damaged.
I mean, was it fair to say that really only the Jewish were terrorists? Were there Arab terrorists too back in the 1940s?
No, not as far as I know. There was some in the country near the settlements, where the Jewish settlements were, the kibbutzes. But I wouldn't, well, I suppose they would be terrorists. Yeah, I suppose in their own way.
And so you went on after that to join the army. Why did you do that?
Boredom.
Just tell us about when the day you left Palestine. You know, what was in your mind at the time?
Well, I was hoping to get another job in the colonies. But, of course, I stayed on a little bit after the mandate finished. The mandate finished in May, and we stayed on a little longer, two groups of us in Haifa, one end and one the other, so they could get the rest of the stores and the equipment and everything could be got out without any trouble.
And was it? I mean, did you find there was much trouble during that period? Or
only
you...
between the Arabs and the Jews.
Oh, right. Not they were quite happy to leave you alone once they knew you were going.
Well, they our station, which was a trade school, the other end of Haifa to me, they got involved in quite a little battle with armoured cars against the Arabs. Whether the Arabs thought they were Jews or just decided that they'd have a go. They fought quite a battle for quite a few hours.
And what was the what were you doing in the army then, after you left Palestine?
I was in the tank regiment.
Where?
Started off in Barnard Castle, went to Tidworth.
Right, so that's your training here.
Yeah. Yeah, and then we ended up at Bovington, and then the Korean War started, and we got sent to Korea.
What, with your tanks? You were out fighting in Korea?
Yeah.
Crikey. What? I mean, this is the other side of the world. I mean, you must have thought, well, we've just had this Second World War. What are we doing here? What were you doing there?
Well, the United Nations said that North Korea shouldn't have not invaded South Korea.
Well, so, they're still criticising the North Koreans to this day, aren't they? Yeah. What do you think there was any point in that war, looking back so far?
Well, it's another. With America again, you can hardly tell. It was mostly American troops. There was Belgians and everybody, Philippines, all kinds of troops there, but basically American.
And just give us some experiences that you had in Korea then.
Well, I was mostly on a tank, recovery tank, and we got left behind with a tank we were picking up, and that's when they fought the Battle of the Imjin River with the Gloucesters, and we were the other side of the Imjin when it all happened. Quite a job getting back on our own, but it worked out. We got there.
And what was, I mean, forgive me, I mean, I don't know a lot about the history of the Korean War. What was the end result? Was it anything positive?
Stalemate.
Stalemate.
We went back virtually where it was before, the 38th parallel.
And wasn't it the Chinese that was sort of instigating it, really, through the North Korea?
They came into it. We'd virtually won the war. We'd beaten North Korea. We were way up nearly on the Yalu River. And then the Chinese came in and we came all the way back again. And it's one of those wars that you couldn't win.
Now, I mean, you've also been posted to Hong Kong as well. When was that and what was that like?
Oh, that was a lovely place. Of course, I was married then. My wife was alive then, and she came out there and lived with me out there. Oh, it was a lovely place to be stationed.
And what were you actually doing?
I was in a workshop, army workshop. Just get the bus every morning to work and do my job. Get the bus every morning back. Oh, it was like a civvy job.
Now, I mean, this is. It sounds almost blissful, sort of being posted to these exotic locations. These various colonies, British colonies back in the days of really the vestiges of empire. But I mean, aren't you really just part of a dreadful imperialist empire, Bill?
No, I was an imperialist. I suppose 90% of my generation were imperialists.
Well, I mean,
Britain was the greatest country in the world.
Well, you say that, but surely we got great by being bullies, by shoving our way in and taking over places.
Well, if we hadn't have done it, somebody else would have.
Well, that's easy to say. I mean, you could say the Chinese could come over here right now and take over Britain if with that attitude.
If you let them.
With that attitude, though. I mean, surely the idea of, you know, dominating, trying to dominate the world, extend yourself. This is what the Americans are doing right now in places like Afghanistan. I mean, they're going to be pulling back soon, apparently. Syria. They're always trying to extend their influence. I mean, you know, surely the world is only going to work when people start leaving each other alone to get on with their own business.
Yes, but in those days, nobody did.
Okay.
No, you got to face it. You're talking in hindsight. It was a different world.
But I mean, what I'm saying is that the same sort of thing is still going on today, and it's not really getting us anywhere, is it?
It never will.
But you don't think it'll ever go away?
No.
You think people will always start trying to take countries
because
over like that?
If you give people, we'll call it self-determination, there'll always be somebody turns up to take a little bit more.
What do you think about this Scottish independence then, for example? I mean, because they're saying, we want, you know, we want to be in charge of our own affairs. We're getting fed up with being told what to do by Westminster.
Well, I'm all in, if they wish to go, go. But they go completely. I'd say if they go, build Hadrian's Wall back up.
Well, what about, say, someone like the people in Hong Kong, though, for example? Would you give them a vote when you were over there and say, if you want to be independent, we'll make you?
Well, we... Hong Kong was a different situation because we were going to leave anyway. We only had a 100-year lease on it. We didn't. We weren't chased out of Hong Kong. We had a 100-year lease. And the lease was up.
Now, looking back to probably the most interesting part of your time in Palestine, what lessons do you think you can leave us from what you saw there and the way you've seen it develop over the years? Because it's a really horrendous situation now. Many people talk about, you know, the places like Gaza being like prison camps. It's very difficult to get in and out. There's mass poverty inside. And also, when the Israelis invade, it's a massacre of civilians in there. So it's not a nice situation. What advice have you got to try and stop these things, stop that particular situation happening, and stop this kind of thing happening in the future, Bill?
It can't stop now. It could have been stopped in the beginning, when we left. If you think Israel was a very small part of Palestine, they gave it a little bit. There was only settlers in there and immigrants. Now, against them, when we left, turned to Syria, Lebanon, the Palestinians, and the Egyptians. Now, that is a massive army. But when they were started fighting while we were still there waiting to come home, and they were fighting as different people. The Lebanese were fighting as Lebanese, the Syrians were fighting as Syrians, and the Egyptians were fighting. Nobody, and the Jordanians were all fighting as Jordanians. Nobody was fighting as an Arab, as what you believe everything happens. They weren't. They were fighting as independent people. So the Israeli cut them to ribbons.
Well, there's a sort of divided rule, you mean?
Yeah. Well, if you notice today, they're not, we call them Arabs. But they don't. They fight. Don't fight as Arabs.
Yeah, because they're all separate countries with their own influence.
Syria.
I mean, look at Egypt, for example. Yeah. That one country, I mean, they had their own president for a little while, but he was soon removed by the army.
Yeah.
And that army is very closely linked to American money,
yeah,
rather like Israel. It's bizarre, isn't it?
The Egyptian army has always been independent of the government. Always. It's always been a thing of its own. But you take Syria today. We talk of the freedom fighters, those that have been to the conference. But how many separate units are fighting out there? There's no one man saying, I am the general of the freedom fighters.
So is it a little bit like the Balkans, where you've got lots of different countries with loads of different separate fighting
units? People inside
units?
Them, yes. And that's what the Arab nations are. They're a separate mass of people.
So you think the only way for peace in Palestine is for the Israeli government in Tel Aviv to just take the whole lot over?
Terrible thing to say. Yeah.
But, I mean, you know, the minority rights are just not there for people, are they? So the Arabs are not going to accept that.
No, but then again, you don't... what about the Christian Arab? He gets persecuted by the Muslim Arab, and he gets persecuted by the Israelis. And he's an Arab, but he's a Christian.
Okay.
It's a very, very complicated affair. It would take days, and he still wouldn't sort it out.
But this was a situation which was created by the British, wasn't it? So, in a way, you know, it doesn't really live up to your tale of the days of colonialism and that being justified.
But it wasn't a colony. It was a mandated territory given to the British by the League of Nations.
Okay, so the League of Nations were saying, this is a real hot potato here. I tell you what, Britain, you can have it.
Yeah, and they gave that a bit to France, remember? People talk of Britain. We had Palestine, Jordan, and I think parts of Iraq, so I can't remember exactly, but France had Lebanon and Syria. They were French. See, people forget the French were there.
Anyway, Bill, look, I know you're going to be doing a talk in Bristol City Centre this weekend on Sunday. That's the 23rd of February. Can you tell us where and when?
I was at the Palestine Embassy Museum in Broad Street.
Now, it's also known as the Ark Bar, isn't it, that yeah. place? What time?
3 o'clock till 5:30.
And it's not just a talk by you, it's a discussion with who?
There is a Palestinian student coming over, or she's over here already, a young Palestinian, and she's going to talk about modern days Palestine, and I shall be answering questions on the old days of Palestine.
Well, Bill Smith, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect. And if you want to hear a bit more of Bill, go down to Broad Street on Sunday, 3:30. At the Ark Bar, which is towards the bottom of Broad Street on the left-hand side, on Sunday the 23rd of February, you will find Bill and you can ask him anything you want to know about the history of Palestine, because he was there back in 1946-1947. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Now I'm joined by someone who's becoming our resident IT security person in the house, Ed Lander. Hi, Ed.
Hi.
Now, this week, I thought we'd venture into the nasty world of the sync and the cloud. Syncing is backing up, I believe, your phone contents or your computer's contents up to some server somewhere in the remote distance, and the cloud... What is the cloud? Is it just simply a giant hard drive in the sky?
That's probably the simplest way of describing it, yeah. It's a huge array of computers distributed across the planet that are performing all kinds of tasks, crunching numbers, some of them storing data. Huge business now. I believe Amazon offer massive cloud computing and cloud storage capabilities, which people and businesses can hire out to save themselves from having to do that kind of thing in-house, which
oh, right.
is notoriously expensive.
I mean, say, for example, I know if you've got a bit of video editing software and you're saying to it, pressing the button and saying, OK, render me a video now, I mean, if it was all high definition, a sort of big feature film type thing or whatever, you know, you could be sitting to wait for it to render for days and days. And what you're saying is that you can farm this now out to the cloud to get the cloud to do it. So that's not only storage, but also processing power.
Yeah,
so
that's key, exactly. Yeah, if you have a good enough internet connection and that the native file is small enough so that you can quickly transfer that to the cloud or even work on it on the cloud, and then you utilize all of that horsepower, that computing power, to just speed that process up for you, as opposed to running it locally on a desktop machine or something.
Okay, so the cloud, who owns it?
That's a good question. I don't think anybody owns the cloud.
And who has access to it? Because it's clearly not only you.
That's a very good point. Again, personally, I am nervous about storing my personal information in the cloud, seeing as you don't know where that information is actually going to be held. You don't know if it's safe in terms of fire risk, if it's actually going to be there when you need to, you know, sync, as you said. You don't know what legal complications might come about one day, so that information might be seized along with other, you know, you might be sharing machines or a warehouse space with people who are doing nefarious things, and suddenly all of that data just gets seized.
Now, in the example I was using there about a feature film, you might even find that suddenly your feature film comes out in some pirated form
sniffed, yeah, stolen.
Before it's supposed to, you know. So what is there? Is there any security around this that, you know, you can really speak of? Is it just, you know, that what they say is, oh, yes, we endeavour to keep your data secret, or don't they even say that?
I've not looked at any contracts, but it does seem quite faith-based. I'm not aware of any cloud-based sync systems that encrypt on the fly. Obviously, if any unencrypted data is sent over the web to any cloud storage, then it's vulnerable to being intercepted on the way. And again, once it's there, you have to trust that that company has got good enough security systems and isn't particularly a hot target from hackers, so that, you know, they aren't able to break in and get access to that data.
Now, we're talking about cloud, we're talking about sync, but sync is essentially a form of backing up. In the old days, you used to do a backup off of your computer onto some other, maybe onto another drive, which you would leave by the side, you know, in your home.
Yeah.
Backing your data up into the cloud by syncing it, is that again a little bit vulnerable?
I think so. That I haven't been convinced yet that it's entirely safe. And personally, I'm always nervous about surrendering control of my personal data to some other entity, particularly, you know, to gaining access to it. If suddenly you need access to it and you aren't able to, or for some reason or another you don't have a decent internet connection. We're all getting so used to the connected world, and we're forgetting that we do rely on decent internet. And it's often I find myself with appalling mobile phone data coverage, or as it was previously, an appalling home broadband connection, that you do feel a little bit vulnerable.
The connected world, what's this supposed to mean then? I mean, is it really that connected? And quite a lot of times I can't even get a mobile phone signal, let alone connected to the internet.
Well, that's a good point. And there are supposedly strides with the next generation technologies like 4G, 5G mobile coverage to improve this kind of thing. But I know enough about these technologies to know that there are still going to be patchy areas of coverage. But the connected world, I mean, it's just this gradual migration where everything is gaining some kind of internet connection, or at least that's the marketing dream. Google recently acquired a company called Nest, who deal with connected home appliances, and that's the idea of regulating your home environment, your climate, etc., remotely from your mobile phone, or have something semi-intelligent that might communicate with you. And then in the world of automotive, they're talking about having connected vehicles, which raises all kinds of interesting questions about cars being vulnerable to being taken over by external agents.
Well, there was the death last July, a very sad death in the United States, of the investigative journalist Michael Hastings. And he was at his girlfriend's place the evening before with his car, saying, "I don't like this car. It seems to be misbehaving. Can I borrow your car, please?" Literally just a few hours before he was seen accelerating across the center of Los Angeles at 80 miles an hour. And then he crashed into a tree with his car. Now, this was a Mercedes, by the way, brand new Mercedes. And the technology here, there are a lot of questions in the US, and particularly because some senior government people have said, yes, this could be a car hacking. So the connected world is a bit of a two-edged sword, it seems to me, Ed, that maybe by actually opening more and more of our lives to the internet, we're actually opening also to people that might misuse it or hack into it.
Absolutely. It's opening Pandora's box, and those people could be any number of actors. They could be teenagers in Eastern Europe or Russia messing around. They could be corporations trying to get access to certain information. And as you say, in that case of that person's death, I mean, cars and the electronic systems in cars are particularly sophisticated and complicated these days. So it could have been a rare fault that he said he didn't like the car. The car may have had some esoteric problem with it. But also there are known security weaknesses with some of the chips that are going into cars, whereby they're enabling Bluetooth connectivity for typically audio, you know, connecting to your handset, streaming audio. And this actually offers a way to get access to all the car systems. I've had some interesting conversations with other engineers talking about hacking into cars very easily, being able to tamper with the anti-locking brake systems, power-assisted steering.
Now, most famously, I think it's probably Toyota. I mean, a lot of other companies have had what they call unintended acceleration. Now, this is pretty frightening, when the idea that somebody, even without realising what they're doing, can be inside your engine messing around with your accelerator pedal, and you press the pedal, nothing happens, or you press the brake and nothing happens. This is one of the things that was so suspicious about the Michael Hastings death last year, was that one of the police photographed his car as it was screaming past. The policeman then pulled out and went after him. But it's very noticeable, and some smart aleck in the US freeze-framed that film of his car going past, and because it's quite late at night, you can see very clearly he's got his foot on the brake, as he's going down the road at 80 miles an hour. So it looked as if Hastings himself was trying to stop the car, but this car was running away with itself.
A runaway vehicle.
Yeah. So, I mean, for you, someone that works in a fairly high-tech business environment, what can businesses do to protect themselves to make sure that people aren't kind of creeping through that wireless into their business?
That's a very challenging question to answer. I think whenever any company has anything of value, even if it's just intellectual property in their industry, then they will always be a target. And it seems to be that it's very hard to stop these armies of hackers. You know, there are large numbers out there. There are organizations, people's governments who are fascinated to know what other people's corporations, governments are doing.
Well, I suppose the motivation is purely money, isn't it? I mean, if you can find out something that's valuable to somebody's competition, then there's a motive there to start with.
Yeah, it's intellectual property theft. It's a way to try and, you know, catch up with your competitors, cut out all huge amounts of R&D costs if you just borrow all their ideas. And there, you know, there are certain...
Sorry, steal their ideas.
Absolutely. Okay, I said it. Stealing their ideas. I mean, there are certain governments in the world who work very closely with the tech companies and trying to go after them for stealing intellectual property has proven, as far as I understand, very, very tricky indeed, because the courts aren't really truly international, and you just get no penetration because they are protected implicitly.
God, well, this connected world is connecting into us, folks, so we need to be a little bit aware of what's going on. This Nest company that Google have taken over, what kind of things are they doing in our homes? Or the idea of, are they trying to sort of automate various appliances, electrical goods, things like that? I mean, what are they up to?
My understanding about Nest is it's broadly climate control at the moment, but they've got some quite interesting ideas about an intelligent home that sort of learns your habits. I've got echoes of Hal in my head. Imagine your home refusing to let you in because it believes that you shouldn't be back home yet because you're normally out on a Thursday evening playing badminton or something, and therefore you must be an intruder. But yes, it's this idea of your home being smart, and as energy prices go up, there's a lot of interest in having a smart energy system. So heating your home only when someone's in the home or someone's due to come home.
Okay, intelligent homes that think for themselves, sounds a bit scary, folks. One of the big connections into that, of course, is likely to be these smart meters that a lot of the electricity firms are now trying to get installed. In fact, they all, you know, give all sorts of inducements to do that. Sometimes say, well, you know, your electricity bill will be cheaper because we will be able to actually read your meter all the time, this kind of thing. A smart meter might sound smart, but actually it might not be the smartest thing to do. What do you think about that, Ed?
These energy companies are pretending that they're interested in saving you money, when in fact they might have an interest in getting your devices to work at a slightly higher rate than you expect.
Maybe they could even switch your kettle on a few times during the day while you're out in order to charge you a bit more for your electricity.
Yeah, well, yeah, it could possibly be that way.
Well, we mustn't give them ideas, must we?
No, we are. We're terrible. We
must stop. We must stop
ideas
right now. Anyway, be it fascinating chatting again, Ed.
Always a pleasure.
Have another chat next week. Thanks.
Cheers, thanks.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And topic for today, an extra topic, is going to be youth unemployment. We aim to find out what is being done for people out of work for over a period of 6 months in Britain, especially focusing on areas hardest hit, such as the Midlands and the South West, where over 280,000 claimants compared to the last quarter are unemployed. And joining me is Sarah Bromberg. Sarah, what are the latest employment programmes being run in Bristol, and how can you join one?
Well, for a lot of them, you have to be referred by Job Centre Plus, part of the Department for Work and Pensions. There's the Work Experience Programme, which is free government advice for anyone aged between 16 to 24. There's the Work Programme for young people and adults in receipt of Job Seekers Allowance and ESA, for which you have to be in the work-related group and in receipt of benefits. And there's Community Work Placements, which you can also access through Job Centre Plus.
When will we begin to see a change in the job markets, do you think, and easier access to support for people looking for work?
The Department for Work and Pensions has taken a big focus on the work programme since November 2011, a mandatory scheme for those in the work-related group of Employment Support Allowance. According to Bristol Together, 168,000 have escaped from long-term unemployment and found work. And according to The Guardian, UK unemployment rate has fallen to 7.1%.
Well, what about you and your own personal experiences in returning to work, Sarah?
Well, my own personal experience, I've gone to Connections in the past, LearnDirect, Filton College, Next Step and Skills Southwest, all of which are fruitless attempts to get help. In my opinion, the government programmes don't work and something needs to be done to improve the help that people do get who are struggling to find work. I've been 6 years out of work now and want people to know that they're not alone in their struggle. There are thousands of people out there and we just need to find a way to connect, to tell the government that there is a serious problem and to have a voice.
And do you think you'll find a job ultimately?
Yes, but it's not a case of thinking, it's a case of having to live and to get by.
Finally, is it really realistic for people with moderate to severe mental health issues to be really looking for work?
Anyone on ESA, Employment Support Allowance, is referred to an agency such as Pinnacle People, but there have been numerous instances being reported of people feeling overwhelmed by the whole process and being in no place to start work.
Well, fascinating. Thanks very much, Sarah Bromberg, for that report.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And it's time to join Jason Yannakopoulos now for our weekly review of the naughty news, the bad news. Jason, the floods. What's Private Eye saying and what are you saying about the floods?
Private Eye has just got this wonderful front cover. It says, it's got a picture of a diver underwater. It says, Environment visits Somerset.
Environment Minister visits Somerset. What's he actually saying in that little
speech? It says, it's all under control.
Okay, so that's Owen Paterson, who came without his wellies, famously. I don't think he's ever going to live that one down. How you can come to a flood-hit area with no wellies is beyond me. But well, anyway, what else is Private Eye saying about the floods?
Regret me little, but it does talk about the fact that it had been suggested. I mean, there's all talk of dredging. The dredging had been suggested a good few months beforehand.
Well, years, in fact.
Years, yeah.
Now, it was Channel 4 News this week on Monday evening had a report from the Levels where one of the farmers there was saying that the first thing that the Environment Agency did when they took over from the National Rivers Authority in the Levels, responsibility for all the drainage and that kind of thing back in 1995, was guess what?
I don't know.
To auction off all the dredging equipment.
Oh, well, that's clever.
According to them, there was no need to keep it, store it, hold it or anything because they could always buy it in from a commercial company if it was ever needed. But then they decided it was never needed. The other aspect to all of this is that the Treasury rules, apparently, all the money that the Environment Agency get, is they say we only want you to spend money if you're going to get a return for it. Now, I don't know about you, but I think it's quite difficult to imagine getting money in return for dredging. What money would you get back? I mean, building bird sanctuaries is great because you get money back in the future, but not from dredging. So maybe that's why the dredging never happened. Okay, any more stories for us, Jason?
Wayne Bischoff stepping down as chairman of Lloyd Banking Group to take up a position as chair of the Financial Reporting Council.
Right.
Builders, the UK's independent regulator for responsible for promoting high quality corporate governance and reporting to foster investment. And this is the guy who was chairman of Lloyd's Banking Group.
Oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. Because I know their figures were out this week and they were already, I mean, some of the journalists were looking over the figures as they were released and saying, well, this doesn't add up. And this guy is now going to be on the Financial Reporting Council. Because there are two, aren't there? There's the Financial Conduct Authority, which is supposed to be the regulator for banks that doesn't really do any regulation. And then there's the Financial Reporting Council that looks at the accounting firms, the auditors, things like that. So that is pretty frightening. Now,
well, there's actually more on that in the Private Eye. There's a little section on financial regulation, who guards the guards? And it points out that the Financial Reporting Council and the Financial Conduct Authority, they've practically been, how do you put it, marking each other's homework for a while.
Right, so they pass the stuff to each other so they can say, well, what about
there's been a memorandum of understanding between the FCA and the FRC. States that exchange of information will take place at many levels, and the bodies will, among other things, exchange views on matters concerning the behaviour and performance of accounting, actuarial, and auditing professionals working with and for FCA-supervised firms.
Well, I think one of the big problems with these guys is that they're funded by the banks.
Is it? Yeah, and their chairmen are often bankers. This is a problem.
Failed bankers, indeed.
Failed bankers. So this is a problem with self-regulation that we're having.
Self-regulation don't work, folks. Yeah, so scrap it, unless you want to go down the tubes, Britain. Okay, onto a little audio clip, a rare one now, and this is Archbishop Nichols. Archbishop Nichols has had a few things to say about welfare reform, so let's have a listen to him now.
I'm concerned about what some people are, the burden that they are carrying today, and how it seems to be increasingly difficult. Let me give you an example. You know, here's from one man. He said it's quite heartbreaking the way that some of the people are treated, expected to apply for 6 jobs per week online in order to keep their benefits, even if they have no IT skills or no access to a computer. Now, this is a man who's saying, you know, I deal with people every day. Thank goodness there are things like food banks to fill the gap. It's hard to imagine in a town like Cheltenham.
So that's a pretty amazing statement, isn't it? I mean, you know, how on earth are people with no IT skills supposed to use these government computers, especially when they don't actually have one?
It's surprising, actually, how sort of almost one-dimensional the government's approach to unemployment is. I mean, when you consider that there's so many different diverse people in this country, some who are literate, some who aren't literate, some who can use computers, some who aren't use computers, and yet the government's approach is so one-dimensional to every single case.
I mean, there are 3 real ingredients in whether people can find work or not. One is the government, number one, because they set the whole terms of the way the economy works. You know, for many years up until the 1970s, there was full employment in Britain. Pretty much everyone had a job. And if you didn't like where you were, you could swap and find another one fairly easily. But someone somewhere in the 70s and 80s decided to end all that. So you've got the government.
Any idea
one.
Who that might have been?
Certain Lady T.
Yes.
Then you've got the employer. The employers obviously have got a big role in whether people get jobs or not.
Naturally.
And then finally, you've got the poor old employees. Now, it seems to me the employee, people who are unemployed, want to be an employees, always seem to get the blame, Jason. What's going on?
It's largely due to right-wing newspapers. I mean, some of the newspapers are extremely right-wing. Some of them, you know, they're owned by tax-dodging people who like their profits and all of that. And whenever there's a deficit and all that, where sort of paying a little bit more tax would help, they'll just shove it on the people who can't defend themselves.
You also, we mentioned at the top of the show, Change 100. You said you'd tell me what it's all about. You were at this Change 100 gig. What was it?
Ah, more than a gig. It's a scheme. It's done by 2 groups called Vanilla Ventures and Leonard Cheshire Disability. They have got a scheme where some top employers, some from private sector, some actually Barclays is one of them, some at Standard Life, the Brewer SAB Miller, also Leonard Cheshire Disability themselves, this summer will be having some paid internships for disabled university students, and it'll be 3-month internship. You apply by Leonard Cheshire Disability and you state what your disability is. What did you want to achieve out of this? And if you're lucky enough to be accepted, you'll be partnered up with the internship that suits you most.
Now, they call it Change 100. Is that because 100 people are going to benefit?
Ideally, not this year, but certainly in future years. This year, we've only got about 10, 12, 15 places, but we will have more. There's hoping to be more in following years.
Okay. So, any guarantee of a job at the end of it, though?
That I don't know. I think that's up to the employers that working with Vanilla and Land Cheshire Disability.
Yeah, well, it would be nice, wouldn't it, if there was, because it can be
It certainly would. Yeah.
It would be, a little bit more job security goes a long way. Okay, Jason, well, thanks very much for joining us again, and we'll speak to you again next week.
Oh, thanks, Tony.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Time for the What's On Guide with Jeff Sparks.
Thank you. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 21st of February, the Bon Jovi Experience will be performing with support at the Fleece in St. Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £12 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Also on 21st of February, Kirk Brandon of Theatre of Hate and Spear of Destiny fame will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £9 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Bob Dylan. In a career that has spanned over 50 years, he has released 33 studio albums, 11 live albums, 31 compilation albums and numerous singles. This is a song from the essential Bob Dylan and is titled Knocking on Heaven's Door. That was Bob Dylan with Knocking on Heaven's Door from the album The Essential Bob Dylan. For more information, check out www.bobdylan.com. Into Saturday, 22nd of February, Black Wolf will be performing with support from Hand of Dimes, featuring Nev McDonald of Skin fame, and also Scam at the Exchange in Old Market, Bristol. Tickets are £6 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Finally, on the 22nd of February, the Ukulele Funhouse Orchestra will be performing at the Folk House in Park Street, Bristol. Tickets are £10 each and doors open at 7:30 p.m. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
That's all for this week. Dialect's a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Thursday morning. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our studio guests, Bill Smith, Ed Lander and Jason Yannakopoulos. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, contact us through Volunteering Bristol 0117 989 7733. They're on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Until the same time next week, goodbye for now.